Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Welcome to the April 14th, 2026 meeting of the Colorado River Basin Regional Water Quality Board. For everyone joining us in the meeting room, please turn off or silence your cell phones. This meeting is being webcast and recorded, so please speak clearly. This meeting is being conducted in a physical location and is also available via remote access. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. For those in the meeting, in the Zoom meeting, you will be muted with your cameras off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute and your camera will be turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item and then choose to exit the meeting or continue. Board, Gonzalez, would you lead us to the Pledge of Allegiance?
Yes.
Thank you. Chair Perez, Vice Chair Gonzalez.
Good morning, present.
Board Member Beltran.
Present.
Board Member Music.
Present.
Board Member Satin.
Present.
Board Member Wright.
Here.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. For the purpose of this public meeting is the regional board members to obtain testimony information from concerned and affected parties within the Colorado River Basin region regarding water quality issues. We welcome hearing from the public at this time. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request as described in the agenda instructions for those items listed on today's agenda. You will make your comments at the time that the item is being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments will generally be limited to 3 minutes. The board clerk can now identify the speakers who have submitted speaker cards for the public forum.
We do not have any.
Thank you. Okay, we need the, we're moving now to agenda item 3, which is the review and approval of the minutes of the board's prior meeting on February 10th. Does any board member have comments or wish to propose changes to the minutes?
Move approval.
May I have a second?
Second.
Can we have a roll vote, please?
Chair Perez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you. For agenda item 4, we will now hear an update from Laurel Firestone, our liaison to the State Water Resource Control Board.
Hi, good to see you all. I'll give a few updates. One of the updates is that we have issued a notice for our workshop on the status of phase 1 of the Salton Sea Management Program. The workshop will be May 20th at 9 a.m. This year, we will be not traveling down to the region, unfortunately, but we'll be in person up in Sacramento at our Cal EPA building, but there will be remote options, of course, and virtual participation available, as well as Spanish interpretation. Comment period for you can submit an online speaker card to participate, whether you're in person or virtual. Written comments on the Salton Sea Management Program need to be received by Monday, May 11th. But I know that there are a number of in-person meetings that the that CNRA is holding around their annual report to be going through that and getting comments as well. So that is the update on that. We also, at our upcoming meeting next week on Tuesday the 21st, we're going to be considering adoption of our Prop 4 border funding. So again, this is about $46 million from Prop 4 for border projects or projects to address water quality crossing the border. We had to and are proposing to adopt guidelines for how that funding will be administered and through competitive applications. For this one, there's not a set aside for, you know, the two main rivers. It's a competitive process. I think, you know, we do want to make sure that there's good projects across the border. I mean, for the full, both this region and the San Diego region. But we're encouraging folks to comment and participate in that adoption for our guidelines. And then also, of course, most importantly, submit projects to that. We just giving you a sense of things going on at the state board. We have, we just went through our annual priorities discussion. We have, we're finalizing our updated strategic work plan, and I can share that once it's finalized and posted. That just gives an overview of the things that we are trying to get over the finish line this year, as well as ongoing high priority issues and programs. One of those programs is the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We just acted to recognize the improvements in one of the basins that was deemed inadequate by DWR and sent to us for potential probation. They made adequate improvements. And so we are now recommending that they return back to DWR's jurisdiction. We also created for the first time for both the two sub-basins that are on probation, Tulare Lake and Tule sub-basin, minimal impact exclusions, so basically very small pumpers for our exclusions from fees and reporting for our fees and reporting under the probationary designation. And we are at our next meeting going to be considering some additional requests for exclusions for those basins or sub-basin and GSAs, mostly in the Tule. We issued a draft sites reservoir permit for it's really an administrative draft, but that's available for public comment. Written comments are due May 22nd. There will be another draft and comment period, but and then adoption at some point later this year is anticipated. We also are moving through on the Delta Conveyance Project consideration for that change petition. We held a workshop on Mono Lake and we'll be doing a number of staff-led workshops to identify kind of scope and next step for a potential hearing on how we can get that on track. There is an order. We have never met the lake level required in that order. And so the next step was holding a hearing to determine how to, it may be needed to be amended to achieve the lake levels that were required. Let's see, we just held a workshop on the agricultural expert panel's recommendation. And this is, I know, of interest to all the regional boards and certainly this one. It's still in in draft form. Again, this was an expert panel that had specific questions related to requirements in our statewide precedential order that set requirements for irrigated lands regulatory programs in terms of reporting and nitrate, really focused on nitrate impacts to groundwater. There's a draft out, comments are due April 30th, and then a final will be issued by this expert panel and then will be presented to the state board. And certainly this is something we will be wanting to continue to follow up and discuss with regional boards because it may have implications for changes to the precedential order that each of the regions are subject to for the irrigated lands program. And we're expecting to get that information item either June or July with a final report. And let's see, other things I wanted to flag is we're going to be releasing a draft on the Clean Water State Revolving Fund later this month. And we're tentatively going to be having a board workshop on that in mid-May. And of course, this is the annual plan for how we spend our clean water infrastructure money. So look out for that. We also have been making progress on our wastewater needs assessment that is ongoing. There is an advisory group that meets quarterly. But this is starting to be where we narrow down and identify where there are inadequate, at risk, and other high need systems. And so encourage folks that are interested in that to learn more and get involved. And I think with that, could talk about a lot more, just mostly. You know, we are looking at the hydrology of our state, which is, receiving the second lowest snowpack for this time of year on record, and that the warmest temperatures on record. We are in good shape in terms of our reservoirs in state, but obviously for this region, the Colorado River Basin is not in good shape, and this is a issue that nationally, but certainly in California, everyone is working hard to see how we manage both in the short term and longer term. We haven't gotten our update on the Colorado. The Colorado River board yet, but I am happy to share that and invite folks once we do, because I know it's of interest for this region in particular. But I'm happy to answer any questions, and it's good to see you all.
Good morning, Laurel. Thank you for your update. I was wondering, what was the snowpack this year, and are the state water contractors, do they know what percentage of their allocation they're going to receive this year?
Yes. The snowpack, the problem with the snowpack is we got pretty decent precipitation, but either it didn't come in snow or it quickly, the snowpack quickly disappeared with the heat wave in March. The snowpack, I believe, is the, at least especially in the Sierras that are the source of the state water project, is the second worst on record. Again, the reservoirs, though, are in good shape going into this because we've had a couple good years prior to this. And so I, off the very top of my head, I don't remember exactly what the allocations are from the State Water Project. I know my memory is 15%, but I could be wrong. So don't take that as the state contractors know more. But, you know, this is really kind of an example of these extremes that are happening that are still extremes for us, but unfortunately will become more of the new normal, and is why I think that both the state and federal project in particular are really looking at how we need to adjust our ability to store and convey water given this new hydrology that can't rely on snowpack in the way that it used to.
And then once the site's project is under construction, are there any future sites that the state's looking at to store water?
So right now, sites is under a draft permit, so it's not, you know, final what the permit will be again. That's the main one that we are considering under a permitting process for large scale surface water storage or surface storage. There is a lot of groundwater recharge permitting going on. So a big focus and actions that we're doing that I didn't highlight is the groundwater recharge permitting. And we've been really trying to encourage folks from not just doing temporary permit applications during the wet season, but to do 5-year groundwater recharge permits, and have issued quite a lot of those. And then lastly on this, just, you know, the state has kind of new requirements and a new revamped water plan that sets water supply goals and is looking at a variety of strategies, you know, including surface water, groundwater storage, both of those, but also, and of course, stormwater recharge, all of that, but also looking at what conveyance needs are there to complement and enable us to utilize the water that's stored. And then, of course, all the different pieces of the water supply strategy, including, you know, making conservation a way of life, the stormwater capture, water recycling. We have high goals around continuing to expand that, as well as desal, and probably others that I'm forgetting off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Hey, good morning, Laura. I just had a question. I was reading about the International Boundary and Water Commission and the New River Minute Motion that deals with water quality coming across the California border. And I heard that they're working on trying to change that minute motion so that the water quality that does come into Calexico, California, will comply with our water standards, just like it does in San Diego. They already do that in San Diego. Have you heard anything more about that?
I haven't, but that's a great flag, and I can try and learn more. And I know this region has historically been involved in those discussions as well. So I think it's great for this region to look at how it can be involved if it isn't already.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. No more questions, right? Okay. All right. Okay. The board will now consider items on the uncontested calendar. All items appearing under the uncontested items calendar are acted upon by the board in one motion without discussion. There are three items on today's uncontested calendar, agendas items 5, 6, and 7. Item 5 is a rescission and substitution order that rescinds existing orders of various facilities and projects within the Colorado River Basin region. The affected facilities and projects include the California Department of Transportation District A, SCORE, RSP, Replacement Project, located in San Bernardino County, California Department of Transportation, District 8, Cactus City Safety Roadside Rest Area Wastewater Treatment Facility, located in Riverside County, Mitchell's Camp Family Association Domestic Wastewater Treatment System in Imperial County, Kaiser Eagle Mountain LLC Sewage Disposal Facility in Riverside County, Southern California Edison Lugo Mojave Reprep Structure Grid Reliability Maintenance Project located in San Bernardino County. Item 6 is a waste discharge requirements order and the corresponding monitoring and reporting program for the Coachella Sanitary District Wastewater Treatment Plant located in Riverside. Item 7 is waste discharge requirements order and the corresponding monitoring and reporting program for the 29 Hospitalities, Inc., Holiday Inn Express 29 Palms wastewater treatment plant located in San Bernardino. Regarding the uncontested calendar, does any board member wish to remove an item from the uncontested calendar? Any member of the public wishes to remove an item of the uncontested calendar, you'll need to have filled out a speaker card. Madam Clerk, do we have any speaker cards on these items?
There is not.
Thank you. Can I get a motion on the uncontested items listed and a second?
So moved.
Second.
May I have roll call?
Chair Perez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you. That was easy. As there are no items scheduled for today's contested and discussion calendar, the board will now move to the information items on today's agenda, items 8 through 11. Item 8 is a presentation on PG&E Topaz Compressor Station update. Excuse me. The board will now hear the presentation on the PG&E Topaz Compressor Station, which is located near Needles, which is on the board's tour tomorrow. The presentation will include introduction and update from PG&E representative John Glass, followed by presentation from board staff Brianna Allen, Monica Aragon Guzman on the permitted activities and site cleanup projects associated with this facility. Introducing this item will be Monica Aragon. This is an informational item only. No action will be taken.
Distinguished board members, Chair Perez. Members of the public. My name is, can we? Distinguished board members, Chair Perez, members of the public, my name is Monica Aragon Guzman, engineering geologist with the site cleanup and storage underground storage tank unit here in Region 7. It is my pleasure to bring to you today's informational item on the Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, Topaz Compressor Station. This informational item will include three presentations, as previously mentioned. The first presentation, titled Chromium Remediation Update by Mr. John Glass from PG&E, will consist of an update of the status of the groundwater remedy for the hexavalent chromium plume at the site. The second presentation will showcase the PG&E Topaz Compressor Station project with Region 7 Land Disposal Unit and will be presented by engineering geologist Brianna Allen. The third and last presentation aims to provide a project status update for the site cleanup program unit project with PG&E Topaz Compressor Station and will be presented by myself. With that, I am opening the Pacific Gas and Electric Topaz Compressor Station informational item and would like to introduce to you Mr. John Glass from PG&E. Mr. Glass is a program manager for PG&E's Environmental Remediation Group and the project manager for soil and groundwater remediation at the Topaz Compressor Station site. Mr. Glass has been with PG&E for 4 years and has over 25 years of experience leading successful environmental investigations, remedial cleanups, and he holds a BS in biology from Oregon State University. Here's Mr. John Glass and his presentation, Chromium Remediation Update.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing PG&E to come and give an update on our cleanup efforts at the Topaz Compressor Station. Next slide, please. So just a quick overview. We're going to cover these six topics. We're going to review the environmental program, talk a little bit about the historical context and the final groundwater remedy. I'm going to describe the in-situ reactive zone with the performance update and the groundwater remedy construction update that we're currently in the middle of constructing or finalizing. And then I'll cover the soil non-time critical removal action, which is INTEGRA. Excuse me if I say that later as an acronym. And then we'll have some questions and discussions after that, if there are any. Next slide, please. So just a quick overview. PG&E has owned and operated the Topaz Compressor Station since 1951. The purpose of this station is it compresses natural gas from pipelines, transport to up to northern and central California. The next station in line is Hinckley, and that compresses the gas further up north to California. Next slide, please. So our program goals for this site, obviously we want to clean up the soil and groundwater near and at the station. We want to protect public health, environment, and cultural resources. We want to comply with all regulatory deadlines and requirements. We value engagement with tribes, communities, and other stakeholders, and we want to integrate sustainability, health and safety, and cost efficiency throughout this project. Next slide, please. So on this project, we have many stakeholders. Through that, there's a lot of collaboration and coordination throughout this project. We have, I'll just broke it down to three kind of separate categories here. We have federal agencies. There are two lead agencies for the chromium cleanup. One is the Department of Interior, which is listed on top. And for the state is Department of Toxic Substance Control, DTSC. On the federal side, we also deal with Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Reclamation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And on the state side, obviously, we deal with collaborate with the Water Board, California or the Colorado Basin Water Board, AADQ, Caltrans, Department of Transportation on the Arizona side, Metropolitan Water District. And for the last category in the middle, we do a lot of collaboration and coordination with Native American tribes. There are six listed here. There are 10 total. These are the six that are located on the Colorado River. And is Hualapai, Fort Mojave Indian Tribe, Chiminawavi, Quitson, Kokopa, and Colorado River Indian Tribe. Next slide, please. So with all the coordination and collaboration that we do, we have several kind of standard meetings that we go through. We have a daily tailboard meeting with the tribal monitors. We go over what were we doing that day for construction of the remedy. And then we have pre-work field reviews. This is just a walkover and review of the construction areas to make sure all the resources are protected and all the mitigation measures are in place. This happens before active work begins at each location. We have a collaboration and protocols during construction. There's a new discovery, a cultural discovery. We have document reviews, and we also have decision-making processes in our protocols. Some of the frequent meetings that we have with all stakeholders is we have a weekly agency coordination meeting. Then we have a consultative working group that meets now quarterly, and that's kind of more of an informational meeting. And then we have a technical working group. And that is also quarterly, generally right after the consultative working group. And that deals more of a kind of the technical discussions on the station, or not on the station, but on the remedy. Right now it's mostly on progress and construction. Then we have another meeting, which is called the Clearinghouse Task Force. That is also meeting quarterly now. That is where we kind of discuss any issues, how do we work through them, and how do we continue to move this project forward. We'll also have a Cultural Historical Properties Management Plan, CHIMP. And those meetings are quarterly also. Those are confidential because they do talk about historical and cultural sites. And then there's a monthly tribal update meeting, and that's with the tribes and PG&E. And you see the photos on the left. That is, we had a site orientation meeting as we were getting ready to kick off construction again. So we had an orientation meeting with tribes, agencies, and many other stakeholders attended that meeting. Next slide, please. Now we're just going to the historical context and the final remedy. So, as I mentioned, the station was started operating in 1951. During that time, an additive containing chromium was used to prevent corrosion, standard practice at the time. This resulted in contamination of the groundwater with hexavalent chromium. And then in 1964, we started treatment of the wastewater to remove hexavalent chromium from the cooling water. And in 1985, we discontinued the use of this chromium-based additive. And there'll be a little more details there on that. Next slide, please. All right, it's kind of a groundwater investigation and remedy timeline. Again, I already mentioned the station started operating in 1951. This was the use of the chromium in the cooling towers. Again, the treatment of that chromium started happening in 1964, and then the additive was discontinued in 1985. In the mid-90s, hexavalent chromium was detected in groundwater, and hence an investigation order came with the DTSE, and we started investigating the groundwater plume. Fast forward to 2004, there was a detection of hexavalent chromium near the river. This resulted in interim measures 1 and 2 in 2004, and in 2005, implementation of interim measure 3, which is a big groundwater extraction system along the river, was implemented in 2005, and that operated until 2021. During this time period, we had increased our engagement with stakeholders and tribes. Then off to 2011 and 2017, following the investigations, a decision was made on the final groundwater remedy, which I'll go into a little bit later. So options were evaluated, a final remedy was selected, and then detailed designs were in process with collaboration and consultation with agencies, tribes, and other stakeholders. Fast forward to 2018, the remedy was approved, and construction began in 2018. The in-situ reactive zone was installed in 2021, and it was started at the end of 2021. And hence, we shut off the interim measure 3 system. And currently, we are in phase 2 of construction. That began in 2022. A little bit of context. There was a pause in 2024 to 2025 as we were waiting for a decision on a modified design. A decision was rendered, and we started construction again in 2025. Next slide, please. So again, our whole goal here is to protect the Colorado River. We've had decades of monitoring showing that through the interim actions and the final remedy along the National Trails Highway, which is the in-situ reactive zone, the remedy is protecting the Colorado River. We have several points along the river, surface water samples along the river. Next slide, please. Groundwater update. So when the design was, when the base of the design was created, the plume, as you can see on the, is in yellow. That's what the plume was at the time. That's basically when IM3 started in 2005. So basically through the efforts of that and the operation of the in-situ reactive zone, which started in 2021 again, nearly 50% of the hexavalent chromium mass has already been treated and removed. And you can already see progress of the plume is shrinking from our last quarterly update in fourth quarter of 2025. I guess the last note there is, the phase 2B construction is ongoing. We started that in, like I said, 2025. We've made some good progress, and I'll share that a little bit later. So the final remedy, what is it? We have an in-situ remediation with a freshwater flushing. Basically, as I mentioned before, along National Trails Highway in green, that is our treatment zone, our in-situ reactive zone. Basically, we inject ethanol as a food source for the native bacteria in the soil. The hexavalent chromium is transformed, reduced into non-toxic trivalent chromium, and that is once it turns to trivalent chromium, it sequesters out of the water, and then it becomes part of the soil. And we also have a freshwater injection, which you can see with the blue arrows. Basically, the idea is to push the chromium towards the treatment zone. And then at the bottom, a little note, it's called East Ravine. Basically, it's a series of extraction wells, extraction and injection wells. Next slide, please. All right, how's it going? The performance of the IRZ. So when we started in fourth quarter of 2021, this is the baseline. You can see a lot of the dark browns. That's greater than 1,000 ppb. And then kind of the later shades goes down to 100 ppb. And then 32 is our cleanup number. To get a little oriented, on the right is the south end of the IRZ system, or the in-situ reactive zone system along National Trails Highway, and then the left side is north, away from the compressor station. A key point that you can see here is when we started, the middle part of the plume, as you get away from the bedrock, you get the alluvium gets deeper and deeper. It's a bifurcated plume. So that was a little bit of a surprise when we started this, but there we go. Next slide, please. Fast forward to the fourth quarter of 2025. As you can see, we've made tremendous progress. Most of the area along the National Trails Highway is not attacked to low concentrations. You obviously see there's some concentrations at like 1,000. You see there's a IRZ-23, and there's blue arrows. Basically, that's our big extraction well. So it's capturing the chromium at that location. So we're not injecting ethanol in that location. We're extracting because we need water for injection. So that's our big extraction well on the floodplain. You also see out by IRZ-13 a little bit of plume. That is captured by IRZ-13. And then we've got some remnant at MW-75 and MW-47. We've shown in a pilot test we can capture that if we operate IRZ-13 and IRZ-9 at a higher capacity, which we'll do if we need to. But right now it's just stable and sitting there. Next slide, please. So evidence of its working, basically, like I said, in late 2021, we started operating. You can see in a few quick months, concentrations in 26 and also 51, which are circled in red there. They quickly dropped from over 2,000 down to a couple hundred, basically now down to non-detect. So yeah, it is working. Next slide, please. And just a quick update. I mentioned phase 2A and phase 2B earlier. We did have phase 1. That was the treatment system along the National Trails Highway. Again, that was from 2018 to 2021. Basically, we built the Carmen building, the tanks, the pipes, the conduit, and the drill systems. And those of you that are going on the tour tomorrow, we'll show you that location. We also installed 55 new remediation wells and 74 additional monitoring wells during that phase of work. In 2022, we restarted construction phase 2A. This was basic infrastructure that was also in our design mod and also in the basis of design. So we installed a bunch of augmented the well network and pipeline network, which included 13 new remediation wells. And for phase 2B, we are constructing the 2015 basis of design. Basically, we're working on the amended water circulation loop that's in the uplands in East Ravine. I'll show that, I think, the next slide. The Arizona freshwater pipeline and other infrastructure related to the remedy is under construction now. So what's shown here, this is what was left when we stopped in 2024. The blue is what's been completed since we started in April of 2025. You can see the pipeline B, the Arizona side, and California side has been completed. We've installed 10 monitoring wells in that time period, and we've installed 3 remediation wells in that time period. We still have 2 remediation wells left to install and 4 monitoring wells left to install in that program, in the drilling program. So, as you see, it's been a tremendous amount of progress in a short period of time, in basically about a year. And we look to continue moving forward with the progress made on the system. Next slide, please. Soil non-time critical removal action. Just an update. I think last time we were here, we were still wrapping that up. So just a quick update on that. This was a federal directive removal action of contaminated soil at 9 locations on federal land or land that could affect federal land. The work started in July 2022. We wrapped it up in May 2024. If you see on the figure to the left, the red, yellow hatched, that was the original excavation boundaries. But through the removal action, we found the contamination was more extensive. So we had to remove soil that was basically up to the yellow highlights. So what did that result in? A little over 34,000 cubic yards was excavated. Of those 34,000 cubic yards, 17 of them were physically screened for possible reuse on the site. And of that, the clean rock was screened out of back cave wash and was available for backfill and reuse. And the excavations range in depth to half a foot to 10 feet. And the completion report was approved in February of 2025. Next steps, we have a post-Integra soil risk assessment addendum that's currently in with the agencies and stakeholders for review. We're anticipating approval in this year, in 2026. And then after that, we'll move on to the corrective measures study and feasibility study. I think that's it, yeah. Any questions?
I have one. You mentioned that you could operate the IRZ at a higher capacity to alleviate the remaining contamination. What does that mean to be operating this line at a higher capacity?
Yeah, so along the in-situ reactive zone, we have so many injection wells and extraction wells. Right now we have an injection capacity, so we can only extract about 140 gallons a minute at a time. But once we get all the rest of the system up and operating, we'll have places to put more extracted water into the recirculation loop wells. So so we can extract at a higher rate, basically.
So you're just injecting more water to flush more out to reach capacity. Is that, sorry, did I, or you're extracting more to put back in?
Yeah, we're extracting more to put back in, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
No further questions? Thank you.
All right, well, thank you for the opportunity to share the progress we've made.
Okay, for agenda item 9, the board will now hear a report from Executive Director Michael. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm really ahead of myself. Thanks. Sorry about that.
Thank you, John. Good morning, Chair Perez, members of the board, members of the public. My name is Brianna Allen. I am an engineering geologist in the Land Disposal Unit. Today, I will be presenting on a facility for which I serve as the case manager, the PG&E Topok Compressor Station. Next slide. The Topok Compressor Station occupies about 15 acres within a 65-acre parcel owned by PG&E. As stated in John's presentation, PG&E began operating the station in 1951 to compress natural gas and move it through pipelines to its service areas in central and northern California. The Topok Compressor Station is also the first station in California to receive natural gas coming in from out of state. Once the gas reaches the site, it is compressed and then sent on to the Hinkley Compressor Station for further distribution. A compressor station functions by receiving natural gas through pipelines, compressing it, and pushing it onward to additional compressor stations or distribution points. This compression process generates a significant amount of heat within the equipment. To manage that heat, the system uses fresh water to cool the compressed gas and oil to lubricate the machinery. During operation, chemicals are added to the cooling water to reduce corrosion, inhibit algae and bacterial growth, and protect the equipment. That cooling water is periodically exchanged and disposed of as part of routine maintenance activities. Next slide, please. Wastewater disposal at the site began with the installation of 4 single-lined percolation ponds. PG&E constructed these ponds in 1971, and because they were built with a single liner, they did not meet the later adopted 1984 Title 27 construction standards for Class II surface impoundments. The 1975 order authorized PG&E to dispose of up to 30,000 gallons per day of chromate-containing wastewater into the percolation ponds. This order also prohibited PG&E from discharging wastewater to the Colorado River or any tributary channels, including Batcave Wash. Later, the 1985 order required PG&E to replace all chromate-based cooling tower inhibitors with phosphate-based inhibitors, which is a practice that continues today. The percolation ponds were clean closed in 1988 in accordance with Title 27 requirements. Next slide, please. Today, under the 2018 order, the Land Disposal Unit oversees the cooling tower operations at the compressor station that generates blowdown wastewater, which is disposed of in 4 Class II surface impoundments. These units are regulated under the California Code of Regulations, Title 27, Division 2, Subdivision 1, commonly referred to as Title 27, which was adopted in 1984. Under Title 27, the Regional Water Board, under State Water Board authority, regulates the water quality aspects of discharges of solid waste and designated waste to land for treatment, storage, or disposal. These regulations established waste and site classifications and defined the waste management requirements for landfills, surface impoundments, waste piles, and land treatment units. The area outlined in pink on the map represents the remnants of the Topok Maze, a place of religious significance for 6 tribes involved in the preservation of their heritage and the protection of historical and cultural resources around the project. Historically, the Topok Maze extended south to the edge of the Chemehuevi Mountains and covered several miles eastward and northward toward the railroad and Highway 40. Next slide, please. The 1988 order established the four Class II surface impoundments according to Title 27 regulations, and the former evaporation ponds were closed in accordance with clean closure standards under Title 27. The photo on the left shows an aerial view of the ponds. The photo on the top right shows Pond 1, and the photo on the bottom right shows the discharge points where water enters the ponds via a wastewater line. As shown in the Pond 4 figure, a wastewater dispersal system is installed along the pond's perimeter to enhance evaporation rates. This would explain the brownish discoloration visible on the right side of that pond's surface. Under the current 2018 order, the Regional Water Board ensures that PG&E is maintaining the integrity of the ponds by conducting weekly inspections of the pond's sister systems, such as ensuring liners are free of tears or other impairments, damages to berms, and or piping. The discharger is also required to maintain 2 feet of freeboard to ensure the pond's wastewater never goes over capacity. Next slide, please. As mentioned, the surface impoundments at PG&E are Class II surface impoundments, as required under the 2018 order. A surface impoundment is an engineered unit designed to contain liquid or semi-liquid waste for treatment or disposal. Under Title 27, these units must meet specific design, construction, and operational standards to protect water quality. A compliant Class II unit typically requires a subground foundation composed of native or engineered soil, a low permeability soil layer, primary geomembrane liner, leachate collection and removal system, and a secondary liner on top of the leachate collection and removal system. The surface impoundments, as shown in the photo, at PG&E are as follows. A base layer consisting of native soil, a 2-foot compacted clay layer, a 40 mil high-density polyethylene primary liner, the leachate collection and removal system comprised of the geonet and collection piping, and 2 60-mil high-density polyethylene liners. Next slide, please. This slide depicts the groundwater monitoring network. Under the 2018 PG&E order, PG&E is required to submit annual monitoring reports that include data gathered from 7 groundwater monitoring wells, sludge samples from the 4 Class II surface impoundments, 8 leachate collection and removal system pumps, there are 2 pumps per pond, and 18 lysimeters. The required sludge analysis includes metals, fluoride, and fish bioassay to determine whether the sludge is hazardous. Groundwater monitoring focuses on TDS, molybdenum, and total chromium. Although the current permit authorizes the ponds to accept wastewater generated by the remedy, most remedy wastewater has been reinjected to date. As of today, PG&E has had no permit violations and remains in compliance with the 2018 waste discharge requirements. Next slide, please. The 2018 order also requires PG&E to notify the land disposal unit case manager, myself, of any spills that occur at either the compressor station or the pond locations. PG&E initiates this process with a verbal notification that includes all available information, such as the estimated release volumes, the spill location, and the probable cause. The land disposal unit case manager then informs the site cleanup case manager, which is Monica, who subsequently notifies the Department of Toxic Substances Control, or referred to as DTSC. In 2025, 3 major releases occurred at the compressor station, including the January spill of approximately 6,500 gallons of jacket water, of which an estimated 60% migrated offsite on the northern side of the compressor station. For reference, jacket water is the non-hazardous cooling water used in the compressor's closed-loop system, and PG&E collected samples at several locations where water had pooled to confirm it was indeed non-hazardous. In response to this, PG&E has begun removing all existing piping at the compressor station and initiated the installation of new piping infrastructure, with completion expected by the end of May 26. Throughout the entire process, I've stayed in regular communication with Monica to make sure information was shared quickly and that our responses remain coordinated. Next slide, please. That concludes my presentation. Thank you for your time. Please let me know if you have any questions for me.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Distinguished board members, Chair Perez, members of the public, again, my name is Monica Aragon Guzman, engineering geologist for the site cleanup unit, an underground storage tank unit here in Region 7. Today, I will be providing a project status update for the PG&E Topaw Compressor Station case that I oversee for our region. Next slide. The items for discussion today will include a description of the Regional Water Board involvement. Oh, one back. Yeah, they all look like. Here we go. And the next one. So a description of the Regional Water Board involvement, followed by an outline of the site cleanup program unit tasks. A quick recap of the status of the hexavalent chromium plume. Discussion of the hexavalent chromium plume impacted areas leading to the background of our PFAS order, and I will explain a little later what PFAS are. A short overview of PFAS, followed by a discussion of the PFAS investigative order and the current status of the project PFAS-related activities. Next slide. So to understand the Regional Water Board's current open environmental case under the site cleanup program for this industrial site, as associated with the discharge of hexavalent chromium and our current per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances known as PFAS, so the PFAS investigative order, we need to understand the processes that occur within it. As we heard earlier, natural gas arrives to the station via piping, gets compressed, and is pushed through pipelines onto other points of distribution and compressor stations. It is the hazardous chemical and historical additives used in the cooling process that are central to the action under the site cleanup case. Chemicals that were used and discharged since the compressor station began operations in 1951. This date is of importance as it applies to our current PFAS investigative order at the potential historical use of PFAS-containing chemicals in the cooling process as biocides and in temperature regulation. Next slide. The site cleanup program that I oversee extends through two areas. The first area highlighted in green shows the locations subject to regulatory oversight under the site cleanup unit case, including the compressor station at the bottom center, and as well as what was discussed earlier in reference to the groundwater remedy, including the hexavalent chromium plume, and the former online ponds location at the bottom left. Next slide. This area extends to Arizona, not specifically because there's work conducted there, but as we saw, pipelines are being constructed from Arizona onto California because the approved water source for the remedy by the Regional Water Board is located there. And we can see it here in the outline of well HNWR1. Next slide. The second area involves, Thanks. The second area involves the PG&E TOPOC remediation offices, where we will be meeting for tomorrow's site tour, and also the temporary soil storage yard, which houses investigation-derived soils pending off-site disposal, depending on sampling results. The Regional Water Board is the secondary agency overseeing the hexavalent chromium site cleanup unit project, which is overseen primarily by the Department of Toxic Substances Control, or DTSC, and the United States Department of Interior, or DOI. This is due to the project being a RCRA, or Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and CERCLA, or Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act site, extending between two states, involving the Colorado River, and having Native American tribes involvement. However, the Regional Water Board is the primary agency overseeing the PFAS-involved work through investigative order that was issued in December 2024. Next slide. The Regional Water Board's role as a secondary agency is to oversee the protection of the waters of the state and the U.S., which includes groundwater. We provide comments on deliverables issued by PG&E as requested by DTSC and consult with DTSC and DOI on project items. We also attend weekly and quarterly meetings related to the groundwater aspect of the project that were discussed in John's presentation earlier. I guess next slide. As needed, we also conduct site inspections with DTSC and notify DTSC of spills and leaks that we receive from the land disposal unit. Here we can see the photos that were taken near the Interim Measures 3 facility while having a tour of the current monitoring and injection well installation activities at the top right. So, in relation to the land disposal project, we notified DTSC of any spills and leaks that we get. We get notified by the land disposal unit. And we also issue non-hazardous discharge-related permits associated with hydrostatic pipeline testing. So what is happening at the site? Since 2005, the remedial interim measures consisted of the operation of a variety of remedial technologies such as pump and treat, including the installation of the Interim Measures 3 facility for the treatment of the impacted groundwater. And as we saw in PG&E's presentation, in terms of groundwater impact at the right, we see the estimated extent of the hexavalent chromium plume at 32 parts per billion, which is the regional screening level for the site, as it was observed in 2015. So that is the outline in yellow. And this is what was used as the basis of the groundwater remedy design. We also see the 2022 plume boundary here, which is the plume, how the plume was at the end of the Interim Measure 3 facility when it was placed up on layup mode in March 2022 in accordance with the approved Interim Measure decommissioning work plan. Please note the area in pink, which is the approximate location and of the cross-section transects that we'll be discussing in the next slides, and represents the reactive zone of the groundwater remedy. Next. So you guys already saw this image, but here I wanted to bring up some attention in terms of what had been seen from the last board meeting where we had an update for the PG&E Topaz Compressor Station. So we can see that since the application of the groundwater remedy within the reactive zone, the presence of hexavalent chromium, as shown in the cross-section, has diminished. So we were presented with the information as of December 2023. And next. And then I'm repeating December 2023 for comparison to today. We can see that the concentrations continue to decline as the sizes of the plume within the reactive zone have continued to decline. And John provided an explanation as to why we're seeing these concentrations, because this is the areas where water is being extracted. So they want to bring the hexavalent chromium contaminated water into those areas for treatment and recirculation. Next. Here we see the overall plume. This is a representation of the shallow hexavalent chromium plume. And I bring up to your attention, again, the reactive zone in pink. So we can see a reduction in concentrations from the darker colors switching to the lighter colors. From December 2021 to December 2023, we can see that there's been a reduction in concentrations within the reactive zone. That's why the that area appears without any colors, which basically indicates that concentrations within there are likely to be below reportable limits or concentrations. And by December 2025, we can see that the plume has diminished in size, and the reportable concentrations have been removed in front of the reactive zone, which beats really well for how the application of the current groundwater remedy is going. And they still have the completion of the phase 2B, which aims to install additional injection wells that will push fresh groundwater so that they can push the captured, so that it can capture the impacted hexavalent chromium prime water and send it towards the reactive area. Next. With regards to soil impact at the compressor station site, areas of concern have been identified and are depicted here in green. While the focus of the Regional Water Board is surface water and groundwater, we do continue to be involved in the review of documents prepared as part of this overall site investigation. The soil contamination is intrinsically related to groundwater impacts, and as such, the site cleanup unit staff remain informed and provide comment to DTSC on reports prepared to evaluate and address soil contamination. There are approximately 42 areas of concern that have been identified to date, out of which 15 areas we can see on the left side are located outside of the station grounds, and I bring up to your attention Bat Cave Wash and the East Ravine. We'll be discussing a little bit later. And 27 areas have been located within station grounds that are shown on the right side photo. To date, as we explained earlier, time-critical soil removal at the site mandated by DTSC was completed in 2023, including non-time-critical removal assessment of soil down to 10 feet ordered by DOI that was completed on May 2024. And the draft Human Health and Environment Risk Assessment Report has been issued for review. The Regional Water Board has provided those comments, and the response to comments protocol, it's in its final stages. Next. So in line with the review that we conduct of these reports, in 2023, during the review of PG&E's site investigation report, the Regional Water Board staff requested clarification on historical fire training activities at the compressor station, examples that we see here on the photos at the right, including the use of aqueous film-forming foam containing PFAS. The Water Board staff suggested that unless PG&E could demonstrate that PFAS usage was not part of the station practices, that PFAS should be incorporated as a potential constituent of concern and sampling be conducted. PG&E's response indicated that there was no evidence of fire training activities, including PFAS containing foam, and the training involved the use of handheld fire extinguishers that do not contain PFAS, and that available evidence indicated that historical fire suppression techniques and training activities at the compressor station did not involve their use. This response was deemed incomplete and unsatisfactory by Regional Water Board staff due to the lack of information on employee interviews, the source of information of the firefighting training activities, as well as the unlikelihood that emergency response plans for the compressor station would have been limited to the use of fire extinguishers in the event of a fire for a facility as large as the compressor station. Next. So in 2024, Regional Water Board staff reviewed multiple technical documents that suggested the presence of PFAS found in polymers typically used in the gas industry and items such as piping, and in chemicals associated with the cooling processes such as those used at the compressor station, most specifically in biocides, meaning that PG&E could have historically unknowingly used PFAS-containing chemicals in a variety of applications that would have resulted in the land applying wastewater containing PFAS. Here we see a picture of the process, the water process pipelines, and the white pipeline, I believe, is one of the gas pipelines where gas is circulating. So before I go further, I want to talk to you a little bit about what PFAS are. PFAS are compounds that are typically carbon atoms linked to each other and bonded to fluorine atoms at most or all of the available carbon bonding sites. They're characterized by light-chain PFAS that we can see in the top photo, or small-chain PFAS. And the large-chain PFAS chemicals are typically considered older, not only because they were manufactured in an earlier stage, but also because larger chain PFAS tend to break down into smaller chain PFAS. So we can use that also to date any kind of impact associated with these chemicals. There are a large group of human-made substances since the 1940s that do not occur naturally in the environment, and they are resistant to heat, water, and oil, which makes them difficult to treat. They're also toxic at relatively low concentrations. We typically evaluate them in nanograms per liter compared to other chemicals, or most chemicals, that are evaluated in milligrams or micrograms per liter. And they're also persistent in the environment and can accumulate within the human body over time, as we can see in the bottom photo. Next slide. So in reviewing the information related to the history of the site and the areas of concern in response to the review of the RCRA site investigation, and understanding the persistence of PFAS in the environment and the impact that the presence of PFAS, would have on the site with the application of the groundwater remedy, the Regional Water Board issued investigative order in December 2024. Aiming to evaluate the presence of PFAS that may affect the implementation of the groundwater remedy. We are one back still.
So go back one?
We'll go back one, yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Given the persistence of these chemicals and the groundwater recirculation component of the groundwater remedy, the application of the groundwater remedy may actually compound the presence of PFAS if PFAS contamination is present at the site. The investigative order stands on its own with the support of DTSC and the Department of Interior, and we have confirmed that a memorandum of understanding with DOI is not needed at this time.
Go back, yeah. It's on
the
timer, that's why.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I guess you guys can look at the photo here to see where Bat Cave Wash is. So the memorandum of understanding with DOI is not needed as part of the current work requested because all the work that we have requested for the investigation is east of Bat Cave Wash. And PFAS investigations can also be conducted while the hexavalent chromium-related activities are ongoing, and we can also use chromium, current existing infrastructure for the groundwater evaluation of hexavalent chromium. While the order is CEQA exempt, we have also confirmed the implementation of Objective 2 activities related to the protection of cultural and historical resources, and are ready to answer any questions and have been providing information to the Native American tribes with related to the PFAS work. That's all right. So to date, PG&E has submitted the historical chemical use report that is currently under my review, and they've also submitted a work plan in December 2025 and conducted that was approved. And have conducted the work plan activities in early 2026. They just submitted the PFAS report documenting the investigation actually this week, And the results of this report will inform future PFAS-related investigations, soil sample, and future groundwater remedy needs. I can say with a preliminary review of the document that very low concentrations, currently below the MCLs or the maximum contaminant levels, have been found of PFAS beneath the site. And we still have a few sampling events to continue. We want to evaluate how, if seasonal changes affect the presence of PFAS, and if there are any other concentrations higher than what we have encountered to date. The photo at the right shows the Topaz compressor station from the East Ravine, which is AOC 10, and is one of the areas where PFAS assessment has been requested. Next. So with that, this concludes the update on the PG&E Topaz compressor station site cleanup program case information and the informational items related to the PG&E Topaz compressor station. Are there any questions?
I have a few. Can you go back to slide 12? Oh, too far.
It's the one after the
next one.
Two more down.
Oh. Yeah, one more. Yeah, so okay, so I'm just trying to piece together this surface map with the transect.
Okay.
And it looks like the transect only has this band, right, of hexavalent contamination going through what appears to be IRZ-25. But this image on the right makes it seem like it's much more dispersed than that. Is that just superficial versus depth? Or?
Okay. So the transect, the cross-section, is actually showing the wells that are located within the pink area, plus or minus user error.
Oh, I see.
Because of the, because it's kind of hard to see in the images. But that was kind of one of the important things to note, that, a lot of the discussion that we have in our meetings is what has been happening within the reactive zone, which is what is represented here in the pink, and that's what the cross-section is showing.
So the future work is going to, I assume, focus then on getting that southwestern quadrant forcing
Correct.
That water. Okay, the transition zone?
Yeah, and the northern portion as well, pushing that over to the reactive zone. So the groundwater remedy will have injection wells for surface clean, considered clean surface water that we are pulling from Arizona into the upgradient or the wells that are located to the left of the photos. And that water is will be pushing the plume towards the reactive zone. So there's a recirculation component, which is is of concern, especially if there's PFAS in the subsurface. And you also have a component of wells around the nearby the river as well, that if they needed to collect water for recirculation, that they will also turn on.
And what's the anticipated time frame for the total cleanup? I mean, you've made great progress in 4 years. How long is it expected to continue?
I can
30 years.
30
years?
Yeah. So, because there's also monitoring.
Right. Let me rephrase that question then. So what's the active cleanup effort? How long is that expected to take? 30 years, and then the monitoring is going to be after that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that just to capture all the trace elements that might remain in the groundwater?
Or? Make sure it's
okay. Clean. Okay. And what's the, I assume that means that the lifespan of the facility is at least another 30 years, it's a perpetual use. Okay. I that's all my questions. So thank you.
Thank you for your questions. Any other questions?
No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Agenda item 9, board will now hear a report from Executive Officer Michael Placencia.
Thank you. Still morning? Good morning, Chair Perez, members of the board, and members of the public. I'm Michael Plasencia, the executive officer. I only have a few items to highlight today, but the reporting in your binders covers January and February. During the month of January and February, staff from the Land Disposal and Water Quality Standards Units coordinated and performed sampling of the New River. Sampling events were carried out for the New River sampling program by preparing sample bottles, coordinating lab contracts, and performing record keeping. Our regional board's tribal coordinator conducted sampling with the Chemehueve Indian Tribe and the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality in support of the Lake Havasu Harmful Algal Bloom Monitoring Program. And staff joined California's Department of Fish and Wildlife's boat crew to sample four sites at the Salton Sea in support of the Salton Sea Management Program. Regional board staff from our site cleanup unit continue to work closely with staff from the Department of Defense to expedite ongoing activities at cleanup sites located at military facilities in our jurisdiction. Finally, I can report back that in January, I issued a satisfaction of settlement agreement letter to the City of Calexico, notifying them that all obligations under their stipulated order adopted by this board in 2023 were satisfied. The stipulated order imposed an $81,000 fine in administrative civil liability to resolve violations of the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit, but suspended that amount pending the completion of two supplemental environmental projects. SEP 1, as originally proposed, involved the removal of invasive tamarisk from the New River. The City of Calexico paid a fine of $27,000 in lieu of completing the first supplemental environmental project. SEP 2 involved the installation of video cameras and new lighting at the stream gauge station, improving security and safety of the area where Regional Water Board staff pool samples for monitoring of the New River. SEP 2 was partially completed in accordance with the stipulated order, with the city electing to pay a required difference of $4,365.36 to the State Water Board's cleanup and abatement account to satisfy this project. With that, I'll just say I'm looking forward to a tour of Tulpak facility tomorrow in Needles, and I appreciate John's efforts to put that tour together and PG&E's support in hosting us. That concludes my report.
Michael, I have a question on page 7. The Jacqueline Cochran Airport. What would trigger us to check for a chlorinated pesticide, and how was that even created?
I'd have to defer to staff on that. Who do I have present? I'll bring Angela Garcia up.
Good afternoon, board. What was the question again?
On Michael's report on page 7, it talks about the Cochran Airport, and it says request for the submittal of an assessment of a chlorinated pesticide. What would trigger that we would even know about that or request that? And what is a chlorinated pesticide? How is that created?
That's crop dusting, right?
Well, they, historically, they were doing pesticide use. They were landing there and doing crop dusting. And so when they started doing sampling, because it's located in an isolated area the airport. So they've been doing sampling because it's been covered with they consider it like a landfill cover. And during the monitoring, they've been detecting samples in the ground and the surface water samples. And so now what we're doing is we're making sure that the previous cap that was there for the pesticides that were found are not leaching onto the surface. So now we're doing additional evaluation to see where the organochloric pesticides are coming from and if the existing cap needs to get redone pretty much.
I have two questions. Did Calexico disclose why they weren't able to complete the tamarisk removal SEP?
It's my understanding that it was down to the timeline for execution of that, since there are benchmarks stipulated in the order, and achievement of getting that in place, getting the contracts in place, getting the work done by the required time was infeasible for them.
Did they get any out, or did they just pay the fine?
SCP-1, the tamarisk removal portion of the stipulated order, was never, they never started it.
Unfortunate.
They paid the full fine.
Okay. Unrelated, I wanted to follow up on the agency coordination item with Caltrans, discussing the use of grouting in their riprap. What's the water board's preference to see ungrouted riprap or to channelize and cover? What's the kind of guidance you're giving?
For that, I'd have
question.
To defer to very specific question. I'll have to defer to our
other.
Good morning. My name is Logan Robb. I'm the Senior Environmental Scientist and the MPDS Program Coordinator. I think it's our preference to have ungrouted rock slope protection. You know, there's a potential for some of the grouting to break off mm-hmm. and enter the waterways. We do allow rocks or grouting in certain circumstances if they can demonstrate that it's needed.
Okay. I'm just glad to hear that. I know I've seen less and less reliance on grouting of riprap and channelization. And
yeah,
I think that's
you know, we're continuing to watch it. Yeah. When they do apply grouting in the rock slope protection, we do require post-construction monitoring.
Oh,
I'm
awesome.
Sorry. Sorry.
That's wonderful to hear. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Logan.
Any further questions? Thank you, Michael.
Don't have a question. I do have a comment. I wanted to congratulate you, Michael, on Secretary Yanya Garcia's appointing you as her designee to the ex officio non-voting member of the New Salton Sea Conservancy. I think it's a great, great idea. I'm glad she chose you.
Thank you, Board Member Wright. I hope to serve well.
It was in the
well.
Newspaper, you know.
Curiously, the first meeting of that conservancy coincides with the WQCC, so I actually won't be able to attend the inaugural meeting.
I think she'll understand.
Thank you. Okay, now we move to agenda item 10, board members' comments and suggestions for future agenda items. Do any board members have anything they wish to discuss?
Yeah, I just have a question for Nancy. In this given age, what is a newspaper?
I don't know. I read it
online.
Okay. I was visualizing a newspaper too, though.
Pardon? Was it the Desert Sun? I don't remember, to tell you the truth.
Thank you. Chair's report. Just want to remind everybody of the upcoming WQCC for May 14th and 15th. And Council. Are there any matters for discussion in closed session?
Yes, we do. Pursuant to Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision A, the board will be meeting in closed session today to discuss the performance of the executive officer.
Thank you. Okay, this concludes today's public meeting. There is a separately noticed public meeting tomorrow, April 15th, at an in-person tour at PG&E Topoc facility near Needles, California. Although no actions will be taken during this tour, a quorum of board members may be present. The tour will be open to the public, though space is extremely limited. Please refer to the meeting notice posted on the board's website for details. Otherwise, the next regular meeting of this board is scheduled for May 12th at 9 a.m. and will be held here at the City of Palm Desert, Riverside County. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Have a great day.